If you are tuning in to the latest episode of No Big Deal and you are a SaaS seller, here are your key takeaways. Number one, you're going to learn how to gain exec access quickly and effectively leverage that throughout the deal cycle. Two, you're going to understand how to sell below the line so you can effectively sell above the line. Three, you're going to learn how to drive urgency without gaining a critical event in your deal cycle. Four, you're going to understand how to effectively build trust, either through face-to-face meetings or if that isn't an option. And lastly, you're going to understand how to better shape decision criteria in your favor. If any of those or something that is top of mind for at the moment, or you think that you may have lost deals or won deals because of that, then tune in. You're in for a roller coaster because me, Jack Nico, and Jack Fox are going to walk you through our most transformative deals today. Tune in.
Let me talk you through the two most emotional, stressful months of my sales career.
It's no big deal to call a CTO and tell I want to talk.
You cannot stand on the sideline and basically wait until the dice rolls itself. It's never going to happen.
I don't know if this is going to be on the record or off the record. It's almost like playing with cards, this job. Like, it's like you get given a hand of cards and like you have to do the best with what you have.
Someone might have been watching down on me.
Me and Jack going into this, when he originally told me exactly the same, like, oh, you know, Jack, I've got this idea, you know, what about this? My first thought was, my God, I don't even care if anyone, like, listens to this, you know. If I take one key takeaway from every recording, I'll be such a better rep.
This is No Big Deal, the sales podcast.
Welcome back. It is series three now of No Big Deal. And if you've been listening to us this much, then you're probably excited for what this episode is going to be. This is probably the most requested episode that we've had, just from me and Jack, though, of wanting to quiver through a deal review done by Jack the Jack and Jack the Jack. And so, without further ado, I will introduce my co-host and co-founder of the No Big Deal podcast, Jack Fox, aka the most notorious beard in SaaS software sales. Jack actually started out in recruitment for his sins, as he always likes to say. And this is a funny story as well. Me and Jack actually met at an event where he'd heard about SalesLoft, which is a company that I now work at, and couldn't believe the challenges that we helped solve. And then he eventually became a SalesLoft customer and then moved to SalesLoft as our first SDR. And historically ran through the ranks at a outrageous pace, promoted from SDR to commercial AE within 5 months, in as a commercial AE, was promoted within 2 years into enterprise. And during that period, he sold over 5 6-figure deals. Pretty meteoric rise. And in that time when we were both colleagues, I learned a lot from him. Now he is one of the first AEs at a software company called Abacum, where he is developing their selling motion and smashing targets like he normally does.
Love it. Before I intro you, can we just talk about that day that we met when it was me, you and Misha at, was it a Natural History Museum? Also, shout out.
Was it?
Yeah, it was. Shout out Ben Henley-Smith, the CEO of Cord, for introducing me to SalesLoft. He's now an outreach customer, though, so give him a ring, Jack. He was like, go and check these guys out. They're amazing. I came to the event, and I was like, does it do this? You were like, yes, mate, it does that. I was like, yeah, but it doesn't do this. You were like, trust me, mate, it does that. I was like, yeah, but does it? I bet it doesn't do all that. You were like, mate, just do a demo. I was like, go away.
Do you know what the best thing was? I remember at the event, you would go and listen to one of the speakers and march back to our booth and be like, does it do that? And you're like, it can't do that. Nothing does that. And I'm like, we do that the best. You're like, I think this might be the best thing I've ever heard.
Man, you must have got that so much at that time. I was that. You must have had that all the time.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, that was a great interaction. I always remember.
Yeah. I'll never forget it either. And that was like I always tell people, that was that moment where I was like, right, I'm quitting my job. I'm quitting my job. Because I was selling SalesLoft internally so much at the time to people at my business to try and get them to use it. I was like, forget about this. I'm really going to do it. Anyway, there's something to be said about really, really, really either believing in the product or being a customer of your product, which we will discuss on the next episode beforehand. But yeah, love it. Thank you, mate, for the intro, the very kind words. My intro to you is very similar. After having met you there, I think, yeah, it's relevant to say that I think you've been to 4 or 5 President's Club in your time at Sales Loft. I don't know if you've ever missed target quarterly or annually. But more importantly, I think what is noteworthy of you that you probably know about yourself, but most people also would say about you, is that everybody learns so much from just being around you. Even if it's not tactically what you do in a deal, it's about just how you approach every day. You're just at it quite annoyingly all the time. And that just is why I think what's going to be really relevant in this conversation, you were the first person that started closing these big deals in our commercial segment at Sales Off. And that is what really inspired me to be like, this is possible, because you did it once. Then about a month later, you did it again. And we had never done it in years. And it was like, due to your intensity and your ability to stay at it for so long, which is why you've been successful for such a long period of time, meant that it was like quite pioneering for other people and quite inspiring for other people to think, oh my God, this is doable. And then I was like, right. After me and you had that punch up in the elevator coming down from the top of John Lewis, I was like, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. Not a real punch.
And you closed bigger deals than me.
Yeah, well, within about a month, I was like, I've got a deal with my pipeline. You close it. It can close. I was like, yeah, that's it. So yeah, Jack Meagher, ladies and gentlemen, needs no further introduction.
Thanks very much.
So we're talking about a deal of mine today, quite a big deal for me in my career today. And we're also talking about a deal of yours. I think it's important to note that I don't think either of them are our biggest deals, but I think it's important that they are, like we always ask our guests, they're quite transformative for us in our careers, quite also transformative for us in the way that we approach our day-to-day. And I'm speaking for myself with this one, but my deal in particular was quite reaffirming of my approach to selling. And there's two types of deals. There's the deal that comes in and they're going to buy and you get it closed and you get paid. And, you know, it's a cheap dopamine hit and you'll never work less hard for a deal. And sometimes they're bigger deals and you get paid more for them and the company gets a bigger price tag for them. But they're not as satisfying as the ones where you execute a sales motion perfectly. And the ones where you do every step right, the customer recognizes the value more, they see the impact more, you get a transformation at the company side where they buy your products and things change for their business for the better. You may not even get paid more for it. It might not be the biggest deal you've ever sold. The customer might not even pay the most for it. But for some reason, as a salesperson, they are the ones that feel the most satisfying. And speaking for myself here, that is the deal that I'm going to talk about today. That's how this one played out.
Yeah, very similar to you. I think this was like at a point a couple of years ago where I just closed my biggest deal. I didn't feel like I was the main quarterback of that deal previously. But I learned so much from working with my manager and my VP and like asking for advice from other more senior reps that I felt like the deal that we're going to talk about today was my first big deal where I quarterbacked it. I was, who's that chess grandmaster?
Schumann and Morgan.
Magnus. I was Magnus Carlsen of Sales. Yeah.
Why have I watched him play chess on YouTube?
I was the Queen's Gambit. I was making all the moves and all of the moves were coming off. And I think importantly for me in this one, like we talk a lot on this podcast and we're sponsored by Medic, which both of us are real advocates for, but you can't just win deals with Medic. You have to underpin that with lots of other sales techniques, like selling above and below the line, using like a really effective sales motion where you're guiding the buyer through a process, you're coaching them through how to buy your software, but you're also understanding how their internal process is, and you're using all of those in combination together to be like the Magnus Carlsen of your company when you're in opportunity.
That's interesting, because I say that a lot here, and the words I try and use is like trying to put order in the chaos for the buyer, especially if they're looking at 2 or 3 different solutions and there's 10 people involved in the buying process and there's hundreds of thousands of dollars up for stake. There's people's reputation, blah, 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 blah. And there's nuances and differences to each product, but it's difficult to understand where they are and how effective they are and impactful they might be for each individual customer. It's like bringing some order to the customer's buying process in where it's typically chaotic can win you the deal, even if your solution might not be the best solution, or even if your solution is the most expensive solution. If you create some sort of order through like codifying their requirements or codifying their timelines and helping them meet different checkpoints, you instantly stand out, and you can win deals on that sort of style alone. It doesn't need to be, obviously it helps if your product's better, also helps if your product's cheaper, but you can still win the deal based on that, I think.
100%. And I think you learn this in time, and you learn this from not only wins of yours, but also losses, to know what to do at what specific time, the moves that you want to make or the plays that you want to make. And yeah, I'm looking forward to discussing both of ours where we managed to do this selling motion and underpin it with lots of other selling techniques that, you know, worked out and what we learned along the way. So do you want to give me a quick 1 minute high level overview of what the company sold to, sells and does?
I'll have to give it a very headline review, because I'm actually under NDA with this company in particular, so we can't give you loads of information. But so they're a financial institution, internationally present mostly across Europe, but they also have one of their institutions in the US. And they're a financial group that have a number of different products like lending, borrowing, holding, and so on and so on. Basically, the problem they were facing is that it was disparate. They had loads of different arms, loads of different entities. Impossible to get any vision into what they were doing. And they came to us and a number of other different platforms that consolidate information, data, business systems, and bring them all under one subheading. Nothing brand new. It's what most software companies do to some respect, is, you know, unify data sets and tools and bring them into one place. That's what we do. There's other competitors that do stuff similar. They have different strengths. We have different strengths. They came to us and we were like a real edge case of what they might want. There are other platforms, much bigger names than us, that do the same thing much more simply, a bit cleaner, but they don't have as many sort of nuanced features as we do that can help with different functionalities, which I won't go into because it's not important. Anyway, they weren't in the decision criteria at the time. And so it was on me to try and make our product stand out by bringing some of these other functionalities into the decision criteria to make it more exciting for the customer to look at us. But I was really transparent with the geezer up front and was like, listen, if these extra features aren't important to you, just go and look at those other products. They're going to be probably cheaper. The brand's got more recognition. You know, you'll probably get a better price because, you know, you're a big brand, they're a big brand, and the implementation will be quicker. But if you're interested in having a look at some other areas that we think we can make an impact, let's have another conversation. I was really direct. He was really direct with me back. Ended up having a really great relationship with this guy. We built the decision criteria together. We got access to the group CFO, and we took it all the way to close. And now we're going through the process of implementing it at the moment. And again, it's not the biggest deal I've ever sold, but for me, the thing that made it stand out so much and why it's most important, I think, for my career, was because the way that we sold here at Abacon previously was a lot more transactional, and we would try and win deals quickly and sell them cheap. Not sell them cheap, actually, but we were competitive with the more cheaper products. And I was adamant that we were a sleeping giant and we could sell bigger deals if we just managed to go to bigger customers and just propose them bigger solutions and bigger transformations. But that comes at a price. You have to lose deals, you have to fall over, scrape your knee, get burned, get beat by competitors, get outpriced. You also have to go through longer deal cycles, which can get lost at the last minute. But I was adamant if we stuck at it, we used a good selling process, we qualified with MedPick, we used like above and below the line selling, we sold to the executives as well as the users, as well as the business in general, we found some good metrics that we could apply ourselves to, that we would be able to get one of these deals over the line. And this was the first one that we did. And I don't know, it's not I told you so. I don't want to say I told you so, but it's a bit of I told you so. And it was like, I could see everybody's sort of, it was what you did when you closed the first ones that you closed the sales. It was like, I told you so, this is doable. And now 50% of our pipeline is deals like this. And this was only 3 months ago that we closed this. So 50% of our pipeline has gone from being average order value, much lower, really transactional, to now they're all the same price. And this was the biggest deal we've ever sold. It's not going to be by the end of next week, because we're going to have two deals that are going to be here. And I think And they're not my deals either. They're other people in the team's deals who were previously selling the transactional tickets. And that's quite satisfying for me to know that it's like the mindset. This business has been around for 3 years, but the mindset shifted in 3 months. That if you deploy a proper, successful, well-architected selling motion, that you can win bigger deals and you can go upstream, and that's how you do it. The product has barely changed. The product is exactly the same as it was. But our vision now is bigger and our appetite is bigger. And for me, it's not I told you so, but it feels like, I don't know, we crossed the Rubicon a little bit.
Oh, really good. Yeah, you'd be listening to the rest of this history.
Oh, I actually have.
Great podcast as well.
Yes, I love those too.
I was actually thinking about this when you were talking. If this deal, let's say, we go back 6 months, and if this deal had come into your pipeline early doors at Apicum, what would have been the result?
We would have DQ'd it. I would have been like, we can't handle that. We're not sophisticated enough in our process. Because also the AEs at the time sold the deals on their own. We had help from the founders and we were kind of working with solutions engineers at the time, but we weren't doing it properly. And we never bought product in. We never bought implementation in. We never built relationships. We never visited on site. Those things were a bit out far-fetched. And also we had this mentality that you needed to sell at velocity these smaller deals to get to your target. And this deal did like most of my quarter target in one deal. So, or like at least 2/3 of it. And you can't do that unless you build up a little bit of credibility internally. You've got to be a bit ahead of your target. You kind of got to be a bit ahead of run rate if you want to try and get one of these big deals in. And you also need to know everyone internally, who to bring into a call, what personalities might match your customer. You know, who's good in front of a prospect, who could do a little bit more prep. You need to know the business a little bit more. So if it had come in at the start, I would have just DQ'd it and said, like, I'm not ready, or the business isn't ready, or I don't quite know how the customer's going to respond if I just try and just wing this myself. Whereas having been there for 6 months, it was like, I knew how to build a bit of a hit squad. Like you said, I could quarterback it myself, and I didn't do barely any of the selling to the customer. I did all in the background.
I love the phrase, build the hit squad. I think that's like the right... You're like Avengers team almost, the sales Avengers on your side. It's fascinating how quickly a company ethos can shift in the space of 6 months. All you need is like one catalyst or one rep to go, I think I can do this. Then you have a deployable sales framework and methodology that you can follow.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, if that one rep has done it successfully elsewhere and seen the impact it's had, like what we had at SalesLoft, then it's like, you're so adamant when you speak to people who are a bit skeptical about it. You're like, you have to believe me, this is the right way to do it. Like, I've seen us go from selling transactional deals to selling big deals at another company. The product didn't change. We can do it here as well. We just have to follow these steps. And like, you kind of have to get people on board to believe you. But when you see the impact quite slowly, quite quickly happening, heads start to turn and you kind of get there. So that's the prelim. The deal was like, it's a good deal. Not the biggest deal I've ever sold, but the biggest deal here. Really transformative for the business. Really, really a good stamp on what we can do going forward and a good blueprint for how we can get deals closed in the future. Obviously still work to be done. But yeah, I'll tell you more about how it started and how we built it in a minute. But tell me a little bit about how did this one for you start? Actually, not how did it start. Tell me how did it, why is it the one that you chose? And tell me a little bit of a 1 minute intro to it.
Yeah. The one, why I chose it is because I think it has so many fun twists and turns, and it's the first deal where the first large deal I sold where I can really eloquently tell you I did this because of I did X because of Y. And it took me in my career, I would say this was probably, it was about a year and a half into being an AE where I got to that level, and that's like I knew the product really well. So I've been at SalesLoft for 2.5 years, but this was a year and a half into an AE where I finally was like, I know what I'm doing. This is why. So I think that's why it's important to talk about it. And I can talk about it. The business itself is like, if you sell SaaS software to fintech businesses, you would probably have heard of this company. Very well-established European fintech brand. And something that was really exciting at the time was I made a bit of a name for myself at selling to this segment in H1 of that year. I saw that this segment was getting huge funding rounds like everywhere. And I was like, I just went and attacked, got all of these different accounts like in my name inside of Salesforce and went out with them. And the first two that I closed were still large brands, but I learned so much from like how they sell, the business model, the challenges that the industry was facing, that this company was going to be like my North Star. That was like the biggest one in the market that I had to get, that Salesforce have never cracked, never even had a meeting with. We'd nurtured it for 2 years. They were never like, never going to buy, but it was the North Star. And I'm so glad that I got a crack at this last, almost.
Yeah, that's such a good point, actually, because I forgot about the other two or three before it.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important part of the deal that we're not probably going to discuss, but I thought about that now, that I like went in with a lot of credibility and a lot of confidence that I was the person that was going to, I was their partner of choice. Because I'd done it three or four times before in the space of 6 months.
Yeah, there's something to be said about that when you're still early on in your career. Like we're both still early on in our careers, but there's something to be said about that when you're 1 year in or 2 years in as an AE. You've sold enough deals, but you haven't got bags of life experience. Your commercial acumen probably isn't smart enough yet to really impress a VP level or a C level executive. But in your instance, what you did have was like quite a deep understanding of how this business type operated and how they bought software and also their competitors. What's it called? The Joneses, the next door effect. Like you had that quite quickly, which is really, really powerful and sort of probably outbalanced your lack of experience as a sort of, because this was knocking on mid-market enterprise level sales at the time, but you managed to bridge that gap of experience by having a really tight-knit bit of experience in this sector already.
Yeah, and I think for other reps that are listening to this, like you can get that from speaking to other reps if you do have an opportunity in your pipeline that you have logos in that same industry, go and speak to the reps that have closed those. So you can go into those first and second meetings with a like quite good understanding of their industry, the challenges their industry face, the challenges that you know, your software helps overcome and you come across so much more knowledgeable.
Also, you come across more knowledgeable, but also to yourself, you feel more confident. You're way more confident. Your delivery is easier, it's slicker. You don't waste words. You get to the point faster. People believe you. Maybe that's where we could start, actually, because we've got a few themes that we discussed when we were talking yesterday, but we want to talk about. But what the bit that I love about this deal is that you, like you said, they didn't have really, they never give us a time of day before to talk to sales off. They never gave us a meeting. They were a tough cookie to crack. And you've got a meeting with somebody who is relatively not senior enough to really make a decision. Tell the story about how you used the weakness effectively of not having access to the VP and use that to gather information and then go on to sort of like create a point of view and get the attention of somebody who could make decisions.
Yeah. I think it's like, a lot of our accounts now, when we go in like mid-market and enterprise, is like you don't win it on the first crack. Like you have to build up so much groundswell. So you're so well prepared for when you do get that first meeting with someone, hopefully senior. So like the year leading up to the first meeting that I eventually got with a very senior new leader in this business, I'd spent a lot of time with middle management, nurturing them, coaching them and what like Salesloft does and could help them overcome, but critically as well, understanding like the below the line challenges that the sales reps were facing. Because what I'd learned previously is that when I presented to executive level members, that they're sometimes a bit detached from the like really low down challenges that their sales team, in my case, are facing. And they like being taught things that they don't necessarily know. So I think I'd learned that it worked really well in other deals. And actually, funnily enough, I learned from selling to a competitive sales leader of ours at the time, later on, that any time that we got in front of end users, we would pretty much win the deal, which was like an interesting stat that I learned later on. And it obviously became dividends in this deal. So leading up to that first meeting, I'd always been waiting for this like very senior guy to draw the business. I've been told for 6 months, like, we just need to wait for this guy and then we can kick off a project. We'll wait for this guy. Had that meeting first on. This guy had not really heard of SalesLoft before. And he joined as like the global director of mid-market and SMB sales and marketing, like big dog, pretty much full decision maker. And my meeting was going to be with him first. And I knew I needed to impress him. He basically started that meeting by going like, we don't have any budget. We're not going to buy anything until Q3. And this is Q1. It's like, great. Thanks. Fine with that. God damn it, I've waited a fucking year for this meeting. And you told me that within the first 15 minutes. I was like, do you know what? Let's call him a different name. We'll call him James. James, I've actually been doing a lot of due diligence like in the past 6 to 12 months. I know you're new to the business and I'd actually love to present to you a few things that I've heard from your team about the challenges that they're facing, like in their role, as well as the software that they're currently using. They honestly sat in silence while I delivered this pitch. And I was thinking, I don't think they like this. I don't know how they're taking this. It was really hard to read. He was quite straight-faced. As you probably would be. You wouldn't want to like give all your cards away on this first call with someone that you didn't really know. And it finished like 45 minutes later. Good chat. Shared lots of things that I'd learned about his business, taught him a few things. He was like, okay, cool, Jack. Like, got him the next steps, but it was like 2 weeks' time. You know, it wasn't like, oh, immediately trying to drive urgency. One of the great things was, and we can move on to you after this, when I turned up for that second meeting, they were like, we're going to do this quarter. And I was like, dang. God, I knew that it would work. And I think like when we discussed about this before, driving urgency is like so hard, isn't it? In like opportunity.
It's basically impossible if it doesn't exist already. There's this philosophy that you can, you know, implicate pain. I totally get it. You can find out what the pain is. You can uncover the drivers behind it. You can quantify it. You can, but something always not that believable about it. The people are like, yeah, I get it. Maybe we're getting on. As we are. So cool story. I love your pitch, but it's not a priority right now. To actually do it is so satisfying.
Yeah. I think as well, what was actually quite good in that first meeting that I missed is that I went in with a very high level. Oh, by the way, given the inefficiencies in your current tech stack, this is how much time your team are wasting. And this is what the return of investment could be by implementing SalesLoft. So I was like, decked out going into this first meeting with like really good stuff. And I think I really impressed them because of that.
I mean, it's making me realize how little I do that at the moment when I prepare for my exec presentations. I go through the motions a little bit, just reflect on some of the deals I've had at the moment, some of the deals we've got as a team. We go through the motions and we're like, yes, finally, we've got like the EB or we've got like an executive sponsor coming to a call. Let's show them our product, blah, blah, blah. We don't go, right, you're here now. I know there's other people on the call, but I'm here to impress you. So I'm going to tell you everything we've learned, how we think we can make a change. And let me show you these two specific things, which I know are really important to you, as well as the things that are going to help the team. Like, we don't do that enough. We go into autopilot a little bit and we just go through the product again. The product's quite impressive. So people were a little bit interested anyway, but we don't go all out basically on that call. Because what you've done there, you basically gambled the relationships you built with the below the line folk. You've gambled a little bit to burn those bridges to go, I'm building a new relationship now. Because if it had gone wrong, they would have been like, thanks, Jack, you made us look like an idiot.
And do you know what's actually, when you say that, it's also frustrating for you to say that because I know I've also done that. And I think that probably the reason why I went full gun is because it was a tier one account in an industry that I was very confident in winning.
Yeah, that's true. Something to be said about verticalizing your sales process in that respect.
But yeah, I think that was like a good one. I don't know what I think the lessons from that or the tactical advice I could probably give is that there's so much to be said for before these meetings, try and do as much below the line information gathering. So you're going in with a really, really strong hypothesis of the challenges this business is facing when you have those executive meetings. And you have the opportunity to just reach out to, like, let's say low-level management or even end users of your product to find that stuff out. Generally, people are, like, relatively willing to speak to you, especially if you're, like, sending them value-added content that will help them in their role as well.
Yeah, and there's also something to be said about doing the work to have both sides of the story prepared, to have, like, the frontline manager and the end user story prepared, speak that language, and the VP exec level story prepared and speak that language too. You bridge a gap that they may not even be bridging internally, and you can come up with, or you cannot come up with, because it's not made up, but you can present stories which they may not even be presenting themselves internally. I don't tell my boss the problems. I just think, I'll just try and get on with it and see if we can fix it. I never say, like, by the way, this is totally wrong and let me show you why. I'm just like, he hasn't got time, I haven't got time. If someone else did it, I'd be like, thank you.
I think, do you know what, as well, when I'd done that, I'd earned a lot of trust on the second call that I got, that I was able to then ask very direct questions to get the things that I know I needed at that stage of the opportunity, which was, for me, metrics that I could tie myself to.
Well, let's talk about them, because I've got a note here about how we just discussed about creating urgency.
Yeah.
And there's urgency either exists because, like, you know, there's a legislative change or there's a huge industry shift. Like, you can get...
Well, you've got a critical event with an incumbent provider or...
But so, like, to create it out of the ether is really difficult. You have to do that through, like, a measurable metric, which is costly over a period of time, right? So tell us, in this instance, also, to be clear, I think, sometimes the stars do just align. And you're like, this is working because I'm doing the right things, but I've done these right things in other occasions as well, and it hasn't worked. So it's not to say that, you know, I'm amazing here. I'm just doing the right things, but the situation is also right for it. I think that's also true to say. You can't win every deal, basically. You can't create urgency in every scenario. But tell us, what did you do to magnify the pain, measure it, quantify it, and demonstrate it back? Because that's a really tricky skill.
Yeah, I was able to get, like, a really great strategic goal that they needed to hit that year.
Nice.
And given the information that I had and the amount of, you know, luckily with SellWaft, I can tie myself to, like, a big revenue goal, and given the metrics that I have, I can present back to be like, you know, you have a deficiency in the amount of sales opportunities you're creating at the average order value and the time to close that they're at. You've been hired to make a change, right? You are not going to hit that goal on your current trajectory, and you can't just throw 100 more reps at it and just hope that sticks. It's like throwing shit at the wall, just hoping it sticks. It doesn't work. Well, it does sometimes. And I think that really, really implicated the pain for him. And I was able to build that business case quickly at a high level within two calls. And he turned around and was like, you know, like we said, like, he was like, we're going to do this quarter, done.
It's funny, isn't it? Because sometimes as a salesperson, you know you haven't got enough opportunities to get to your number, but you're like, yeah, I don't know, maybe something will happen and I'll get there. For someone to come in and be like, by the way, you know you're not getting there. You're like, yeah, you're actually right. I can't put this off.
And I think I earn his trust to be able to say that as well.
Yeah. That exists across all different departments. Well, product, no, they're not going to be able to release the product on time. Marketing, no, they're not going to be able to generate enough demand on the next event, right? But we all know that we're not going to be able to do it. We're just hoping that we do get there, unless someone comes in and helps us. People aren't that proactive, I guess. So it's, yeah, lesson there.
Let's
take
the coin. Let's hear about your one, because we've done the sort of fun part of my first deal. And when we chatted about it before, you know, you've already given us, like, a good synopsis that, you know, 6 months ago probably would have DQ'd this deal. And you went in pretty heavy-handed to be like, you know, based on your requirements, you should probably just go and buy that software. But something you did really, really well at the beginning, and is a great theme of our podcast, is you were able to build a pretty strong champion early on. Could you tell us that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got a lot of respect for the guy who created my champion, who became my champion. I actually don't know if we like each other from a business perspective, but I think it's important to point out here, I don't think me and him would be friends. And I don't know why this is relevant to say, but I think there's often a misconception in sales that people buy from people they like, which is true. I think it's important to have a bit of charisma, have a bit of like rapport, be able to like have change of tone. You can ask for different things if you've got a better relationship. And that is true in this instance, but I don't think we'd be mates. We were a bit different in that regard, but I had a lot of respect for him professionally and his approach. And I think he had a lot of respect for me professionally and my approach. And we set that tone really early on. And I said, because I said to him, because I had a bit of a take it or leave it, thank you to No Big Deal approach, in like the tone of my voice was like, this is it. And if you want additional extras, which we think we can have an impact on, then we can carry on this conversation. But if you want just a really cool product use case, I recommend you go over there. I would obviously love it if you had a look at our solution and carried on this conversation. But I'm just going to be very no bullshit about it and say like, this is where you should spend your time. And that kind of won his respect. And then in return, he kind of got more of my time, more of our SE time, and we showed him more of the product. But that's a bit of a double-edged sword, because what happened then was we opened up sort of Pandora's box to decision criteria that could have been anything and everything. It could have been broad. They were picking things out of thin air. Do you do this? Do you do that? And it was like, because we had promised that we had these differentiators, which were kind of nuanced, but really fit their use case. The problem was it was a little bit then infinite than what they might want. And then we had to then try and like guardrail it and say like, let's create a subset of decision criteria that if we match and we meet, you'll move ahead with this like first core use case of the solution. And then we can expand as we go. And because we're a startup, we can help build parts of the product into the roadmap that we know you're interested in. And he liked that too. And then here's quite a funny story. So it's before we did the first demo, I was quite strict that we weren't going to do demos until we had built out like enough discovery and we had built out enough of a decision criteria that we agreed on. And me and the SC spent loads of time combing through the gong calls that we'd had with this guy to find different snippets of questions that he'd asked and things that we'd said we could do to work out what the decision criteria would be. Then the next day we had the call with him and we were like going to present the decision criteria as we saw it and agree it with him. And then we were going to present the demo to him and his boss in person the next day. So we were like, here's your decision criteria. These are the things that are, we stack rank them in critical order. These are the differentiators, which mean you can't go and buy the Salesforce version of us because they don't have this. And these are the pillars of what we're going to achieve. And we were agreeing it, blah, blah, blah. And I remember saying this to Beth at the time. I was like, I've got this really big call today that we're presenting to like my future champion of this deal. And at the time, if you remember, my desk was in the living room. And I was saying to her, like, can you be out of the house and can you take the dog? And she was like, even better, I'm going to be out and I'm going to get the dog walker to come and take the dog out in the morning. So he'll be out for hours and you can have the call yourself. Anyway, the dog walker was late. I was like, oh, the calls started at like 11 and the dog walker's not here. It was like 5 to 11. She still wasn't there. And she texted me saying, I'm going to be there at 5 past. I was like, oh, it's so irritating. So what I did was I left the key in the door on the outside and I started the call. And we've been building up to presenting the decision criteria for like a week. Me and the SE have been doing it. We're like, you're right, mate, blah, blah, blah. We met the guy. How are you going on? We're going to show you the decision criteria. We come in tomorrow to show you. Blah, blah. My dog does this thing where he runs under the sofa when people come in the door. So he knows the dog walker. He goes out with the dog walker all the time. But he as soon as he heard her put the key in the door and I heard it, he ran under the sofa behind me. And I was like, oh, God, this is going to be so annoying. So while I'm presenting to the guy, it's on gong. While I'm presenting to the guy, the dog walker is running around behind me.
Oh my God.
I am like smoke coming out of my ears. And she's like trying to talk to me. I'm obviously pitching to this guy. And then she's on her hands and knees behind me trying to get him out from under the sofa. And I'm there like trying to hold my nerve. I had to just go off screen and carry on presenting and hope that he was looking at the screen share instead. Anyway, she left. I was so angry. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It actually never came up in conversation. I'm never going to mention it. He never mentioned it. It was just between me and the SE. We were both like, what was that woman doing running around your house? I was like, don't ask me. I'm so angry. Anyway, then that's irrelevant. But the the point is we built this decision criteria with these technical differentiators that they really bought into. And then to build him into more of a champion, I noticed that every call we had, he was always in the office. Every day, no matter what day it was, he was in the office. And I was like, you go to the office a lot. He was like, I go to the office 5 days a week. We have a culture here of being in the office. The CFO is here all the time. I was like, right, we're coming to the office to do the demo then. Book out one of your big rooms and we'll do it. Even if it's just four of us, like me and the SE and you and the CFO. He was like, love it. Let's come in. Luckily, they were just down the road from our office. And from then on, we did all meetings in person. And he loved it. And we became, like I said, like I always thought, like, I hope I don't bump into him in the park, or like, I hope I don't bump into him at lunch or whatever, because we had this mutual respect, but it wasn't exactly like we were friendly with each other. And it got to the point where we were going to their office once a week or once every other week to do another presentation, another pitch. Our CEO even flew over to go to their office because we just created this habit that we did everything in person. And that helped us not only build this decision criteria that meant that they really bought into it, we obliterated the competition because they were nowhere to be seen. They're much bigger than us. Obviously, their solution was probably more comprehensive than us in different areas, but they were like so unlocal and we were so local that we had just built a relationship which they couldn't test. And we had new people. Obviously, the business was like 5,000 people. So new people were coming into the deal all the time. You know, everybody's always got their opinions. But it didn't really matter because we had a better relationship with the champion and the CFO than these new people did, because they were like, one guy was in a different country, one guy was in Stockholm, blah, blah, blah. We were like, we know the CFO and the champion better than you do now because we've met them so often. So they were always going to bat for us instead of going to bat for like these difficult questions that came up. So don't get me wrong, people were still trying to add things to the decision criteria. We were still appeasing them in the demos. But the deal started on such a strong foundational relationship that even when there were challenges that were thrown in as the deal progressed, we had executive champion buy-in and we had relationships that you just couldn't challenge.
Yeah, I think it's critical trying to get in front of your buyers as quickly as possible, really, to try and build that stronger relationship. And also, you know, something interesting you said, like when it got into the nitty-gritty later in the deal, they could be pretty candid with you rather than like maybe hold those questions back.
Yeah.
So you were like trying to get in contact with them. They're pieing you off or ghosting you. And it's because they don't like something. Whereas because you built that relationship, they can be like, do you know what, Jack, I really don't like this.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
If you don't have the opportunity or easy opportunity to go and meet in person, like what are some tactical things that you do to try and build trust with buyers during the deal cycle?
And this is again, like the hit squad that I mentioned before, I try and get as many people as I can from our side who I think are a good personality match, or at least have some relevance to their side. So I learned this at Salesloft, but I do it a lot now. Try and find people who speak the same language if they're in a different country. Try and find people who went to the same, like come from the same city or maybe even studied in the same place. Just try and find some mutual connection where if it's only over Zoom, I can bring someone from my side who can break the ice. Good question, though. I'm interested to know how you do it.
Yeah, mine was going to be trying to get like your main points of contact as quickly as possible into an informal messaging format.
Oh my God, yeah. That's such a good point.
So for us, it's like WhatsApp. For the US market, it might be like iMessage, right? And I think a really tactical way of doing that is like once you felt like you've built a bit of trust with your buyer, I always remember like sitting in a deal review in Salesloft and Sanj, one of our old sales directors, when I was doing a deal review on a deal, he was like, why did you ask to WhatsApp that person at that point in the deal? I was like, shit, I don't know. Just instinct, right? Like you just knew that you were like, okay, I think this guy's like slightly trust me. He's probably going to get back to me. Like the worst thing, and I know I've done it on deals before, and I've seen three messages of mine blue ticked. And like, I didn't earn the guy's trust enough that he was comfortable with, or he or her were comfortable with WhatsApping me. But I knew in certain situations instinctively that, okay, this man or woman in the deal, they trust me. I'm going to be like, hey, Jack, like, thought I'd follow up on here. Let me know if you have any questions. Getting that onto an informal messaging where your champion, your points of contact feel comfortable. The amount of questions that they will ask you on WhatsApp rather than ever sending you via email, 100 to 1.
Yeah, agreed. And
just having a bit of like informal banter, like, you know, or whatever, well, the one at the moment, Euros, or, you know, it could be fucking the Olympics, or, you know, anything that's going on.
Changes the tone of the conversation, which is hard to do on Zoom or whatever.
Yeah, massively so. So I think that would be my one.
I also find towards the end of the deal, it helps you with updates. Well, I can ask more candidly for updates over WhatsApp than I can over email. Over email is like an irritating request for an update over email. Whereas over WhatsApp, you can do it a little bit more like, hey, how are you getting on? I wonder if there's an update. doesn't feel bad at all. We'll just go back to it really quickly. Do you know what? I want to move on to like the middle of the deal now, because we a lot about what happens at the start of the deal. And we've actually just had the end of our quarter here, and two deals are massive pushed. And everybody's looking, oh, what happened? Why did they push? Because of X, Y, and Z. And I'm a firm believer, the deal pushed because of what we didn't do at the start. And two of the things that like we didn't do on these deals are the things that you just mentioned. And one of the things I just mentioned is like, we didn't get a quick messaging format with them. We haven't got them on WhatsApp. We haven't got their number. We can't call them whenever we want. And we didn't have access to the EB early on enough in the deal who was sponsoring the project until the end. And they've come in and they've been like, I feel a bit rushed. I want to do it next month or whatever. I want to do it next week. And we're like, oh, we need to get the EB to do this. Can we get their phone number? I'm like, the reason isn't because we didn't do this at the end. The reason is because we didn't do this at the start. So both of us here, what we've described, built good foundations that meant the deal can push through. And I'm interested to know from you, because I remember this deal and it did close on time, which is like, in my opinion, a hallmark of a good deal, if it closes on time.
Talk about your one then.
So, well, yeah. Maybe I'll tell you a little bit. So in the middle of the deal, I had the guy on, we never had email. We never had phone, but we were on email all day and he used it. You could tell on Outlook Messenger. So we spoke on that. But what happened was, and I alluded to it earlier, is that we had, because he was the group CFO who was our exec champion, we had new CFOs who came in who equally had loads of power, loads of stature in the business, loads of reputation, who had their own ideas. And they kept asking us for more demos. And this is where I use something that you have told me about in the past, where I became very strict with like my give and my gets. Well, I was like, yeah, I'll give you another demo. We will organize it only if you get me, you know, the red lines back before we do the demo, or only if you get me access to this, blah, 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 or if you approve the price, or if you approve that we're going to go ahead on this date. And it got to the point where I think this is why me and the guy had such mutual respect for one another. As it got really heated towards the end, the new people were coming in, the price was a bit contentious. They wanted more for the money that we were going to get for it, which is fair enough. We didn't have like hard metrics that we were relying on, but we had this sort of like give and get relationship that we built, where he was always asking things, I was always asking things, but it meant on the last sort of like week of the deal and the last week of the month, we were going into a demo. The demos of four CFOs, group CFO, three CFOs underneath it. I emailed them all individually before the call. Hi, Mr. CFO, this is the agenda. This is what we're going to cover. Let me know if there's anything else you want to know. I did it as a sort of like smoke out any problems. I didn't want them all to be in the same thread, because if two people are in the same email thread, they behave differently. So I wanted them to be in a one-to-one email thread with me so that they could say what they want and it didn't feel like it was going to piss the other person off. But exactly what I anticipated was going to happen happened. They all came back to me with different questions and different requests. Some things that we didn't even do. That goes to show how little they knew about the product, because they hadn't been involved enough. But also things that we just weren't going to have time to do in an hour. So I had now got a new, basically new decision criteria that I had to go back to my champion with. And I was like, using the give-get approach, I was like, I'm going to give you an hour of our time. We're going to try and take through all of these. But what I need from you is that at the end of the call, I need you to tell everybody that the things that we haven't covered, we'll do in the phase two of a rollout once we've got past like the first 6 months. Because if I say that, we're not going to get this through. Nobody's going to believe me. It's just going to sound like a sales line. If you say it, then we will build it and we can get there. But if you don't do it, it's just going to stall this whole thing. We're not even going to get through phase one. He was like, cool, done. I was like, right, I can't believe that worked. So then we had...
Why do you think it worked?
I knew how much he wanted it. He wanted the solution in. Like, it was part of that. It was one of their main objectives. One of their main initiatives is to get a consolidated view of the whole business, which they just didn't have. And he also knew that these other features and functions that we were bringing in were going to benefit him and the group CFO a lot. And it was like, he knew he was willing to burn a few other, not burn, that's not the right word. He knew that some things were going to have to fall by the wayside for them to get to this, end state that they wanted. But he also knew that I didn't have the credibility as an external salesperson to start telling people that we'll do that later. Do you know what I mean? If I just said, yeah, cool, Steve. Sounds like a good idea, but maybe tomorrow. Anyway, back to what I was talking about. Then people were just going to think this guy's a dickhead. Whereas because he did it, I was like, he knew that I was being rational when I said, if you say this instead of I say it, it's probably going to have more of an impact. He was like, totally agree with you. I'll do it. And I think having that, that the CFO also chimed in and said, yeah, sounds like a good idea. We can come on to that later, Steve. But first of all, let's look at what we discussed. And although I had like smoked out the problems, it meant I could handle the problems in time. And it got to the end of the call and we were like, let's do this. And we built, like I mentioned as well, we built the foundations, strong champion, strong decision criteria, strong exec access. And it meant we could validate our price, which is always the hardest part at the end of the deal. Someone wants to come in from procurement and say that I want 10% off that, which is their prerogative. They've got a job to do. But yeah, it helped us towards the end. So I'm always saying to the team here is like, you didn't lose the deal because of what happened in the last week, or the deal didn't sleep because of what happened last week. You lost the deal because of what happened at the start. And it often comes down to metrics, exec access, or champion building. I think those are the three major things. I'd be interested in what your thoughts are about that, actually.
You know, I was actually going to ask you before we maybe move on, like, when you're looking at your deal at the beginning stages, like, what are the ways you're trying to get executive access as quickly as possible?
Oh my God, we just hired this new guy from New York here. He is unbelievable. He's so straight to the point. And he basically says, like, do you think this is, like, he asks these questions in a bit more of a natural way, but do you think this project is going to have a big difference on the business? And they're like, yeah, this is going to be amazing. And he's like, okay, cool. Well, it's not worth either of our time carrying on this conversation unless we invite your VP or your CFO to the next call. I don't... Isn't that good?
It's great, though, because I'd rather know and be like, oh, no, I'd rather need to keep it and be like, okay, cool, you don't get more of my time. It's a give-get, right? If you want to do this project, I need access to the person that holds the budget, makes the decision, signs the check.
He is so good at it. He says it in such a matter-of-fact way. I don't do that. I actually have a bit of a different approach, which I tried to kind of explain this to somebody the other day in a different way, but when I look at the opportunities in my pipeline, as I've moved through the, maybe this is the wrong approach. I'd be interested to know from somebody who's wiser and older than me to tell me this is the wrong approach. But I look through my pipeline and I often think sometimes the product is a perfect fit for the customer. And sometimes the, you know, their tech stack is the perfect tech stack for us. The problem they've got is one that we solve hands down. We've done it time and time again. But sometimes that doesn't get the deal done. You don't have the buy-in from the other side. And you, like, what you've done here is, in your deal, is create a really compelling story about why the change should happen. What I do when I look at my pipeline now is I look at the opportunities where I've got an exec sponsor who wants to make a change. And I just go in on those deals. So I don't try and make a deal and then get the exec sponsor. Obviously I do, but I don't prioritize that. I try and find a deal where there is an exec sponsor already who's really interested in championing the pain or championing the change. I just go hard on that. I'm like, I've got you, you've got me, let's do it. And I build my core around those deals.
Yeah, really smart, right? Makes me think that I should, like, have that ethos as well. Certainly for, like, why would they change? I think that if you're in any deal review and you're a manager and you're sitting looking at pipeline and your rep, or you even as a rep, can't, you have an opportunity in, like, a stage that isn't qualifying and you can't say why they would change now, and why would they buy us. Get rid of it, because you've got fucking no deal, mate.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Just waffle.
It could be suffering from the exact pain that tons of your customers are suffering from. And, you know, they're desperate to change it. But if you haven't got a compelling reason and a person who's going to champion it, you're done. So tell me, we've got to the point where you kind of, like, I can tell where your deal's shaping up and why you've got executive buy-in. But what was amazing about this deal, because I watched it from the sidelines when you closed it, was it had fucking tons of momentum and it was pushing towards this last. You, not only was it well architected, it also, you were very bullish towards the end. You were very single-minded, like, this is getting done. So tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, I think that, like, after that second meeting, when the decision maker or the, like, executive sponsor said, okay, cool, like, we're going to seriously review this in Q1. I don't know if you've heard this phrase, or, like, blood in the water. I knew there was blood in the water. And I think I was at a time in my sales loft career where I was, like, flying. And I was like, rubbing my hands, licking my lips, thinking, like, here we go. I was Magnus Carlsen behind it, and I just, like, moved all of my pieces at the right time, in the right way. And I think I learned that, you know. And importantly, knowing the right moves to make, you have to know the reasons why they wouldn't buy. And that's why you move the pieces. They wouldn't buy because they're nervous that their sales team wouldn't adopt it. What can you do to de-risk that risk? They're nervous that they won't be able to onboard properly. They're nervous that you don't integrate with their current tech stack that well. They're nervous that, or they think that this is just for this part of the team, or maybe they should test it before they roll it out to everyone. And all you're doing when you're trying to figure out those signals in your calls where you're feeling some hesitation, what can you do to de-risk their risk? So for example, like if they're nervous about onboarding, you have your bishop here, who is your head of onboarding, where they're going to talk, they're going to have a very candid conversation. It's not a sales rep doing it. It's the head of onboarding at your business telling them, this is how we onboard customers, make them feel really safe. You're like, this is not, you're not like our first customer. This is pretty standard. Like, we're going to make it really confident. Something as well I did like later on in the deal that I think really helped was to beat competition. They really wanted to know about where the product was going. And I was able to get the executive sponsor on their side with our EVP of product to have like a 30-minute unrecorded conversation about like product roadmap. And that was like really the icing on the cake for them. They were like, they're the really proven partner. I did some other things really successfully, I think, in the deal, like we were going to be a big cost to them. Like, they were going to roll us out to hundreds of their sales team. But luckily, like, I was able to find that we were going to replace some incumbent point solution that they had and also their dialer. So like my cost of moving suddenly became a lot cheaper because we were replacing two tools that they had. And that was part of the business case, like finding out physically how much they paid for these softwares or like a rough estimate. That was really important as well. But yeah, I think like we said at the beginning, looking at your deal with your manager and looking at like your sales qualification framework. And for us, that's MedPick. Like, where are you really weak? Where are you really strong? And coming prepared with each of your calls with questions specifically framed around where you're weak. If you don't have a good understanding of their decision process, send the agenda email before the meeting telling the points of contact on that meeting that you will be asking questions about their internal decision process. So if they don't know it, go and find it out. Do you know what I mean? I think all of these things, when you combine them in a really successful selling motion underpinned by a sales qualification framework, you set yourself up to win a lot more deals and qualify out a lot of shit pipeline a lot quicker. Just like really helps your like whole sales process, I think, and structure your calls and structure the agendas of your calls and the questions that you're going to ask. And I think that probably I did very, very effectively on this. Yeah.
I started asking prospects, if this was free, why wouldn't you buy it?
I like that
shit. They often come out with, maybe I just don't feel comfortable enough about the onboarding, or maybe I just don't feel comfortable enough about this one feature. And it's like, okay, cool. Well, if we show you that, is that it? And they're like, I think so. Cool. Well, let's show you it then. And then all of a sudden you get this point where you're like, I'm closing you. You're closing. If there's anything else to tell me, if not, we're moving. And I think people really kind of like buy into that. So your deal closed on time, didn't it?
Yeah, not without its trials and tribulations on the last day of Q1. And I'll never get, you could probably tell the story of us crowded round. I was like the last deal to come in and I'd already hit my like quarter well below, but this was like big accelerators, biggest deal. This was going to be like a ton of commission for me. And obviously like I wanted it for Q1 because I wanted it for the team and like everyone was there. And
it didn't get better than those that Q1 and Q2 of that year, and maybe even Q3 to an extent, were
just so, me.
Yeah, for all in that moment where your friends are signing deals and you're all in the office and you're drinking tequila shots on the last day, like just bottle it up.
I always remember, I'll never forget this, and you know, our CRO Steve always used to say this, like, you lose your deal so many times before you win it. And we got an email on the last day of the quarter at like 4 p.m. maybe 4 or 5 p.m. from their legal team being like, we can't get this done today. The EB was on holiday with his family and was sat down at dinner. And I was like, I built a really good relationship with, like, so that executive sponsor that we were talking about at the beginning actually ended up, like, the EB changed around, and then they basically were like, he's the budget holder, he can sign the contract. So, like, all of that work I did was, like, amazing, because I basically had my EB was my champion when we got into the latter part of the deal. Which obviously ties into your point, like, in the middle of the executive access early enough. Like, it's probably why the deal got done that. It is the only reason the deal got done that quarter and it didn't fall into Q2.
Yeah.
Because their legal team emailed at, like, 4 or 5 p.m. in the afternoon. We're like, yeah, hey, Jack, like, we can't get this done. And I was, like, WhatsApping James. Like, mate, we said we get it done today. Based on your timelines, like, you have to start onboarding next week. Like, we can't push this back. Like, it's just going to get laid down. And he was like, leave it with me. And about 15-20 minutes later, that legal email like emailed again saying like, hi Jack, few cross wires, we're gonna get it done today. You know, when you like, all of us were just sad, like, oh my god, we've just done all of this work, we're not gonna get it done. And then it turned around. Yeah, so yeah, that's me. So probably that day is also my favorite sales memory.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah. One of mine. I didn't even get the deal closed that month. One of mine too. It was such a good day, man. It's interesting. There's something to be said about the politics involved in sales at like a mid-market enterprise level. Like, you are politicking to get people on side, to get access to power, and get power to advocate for you. Anyway, politics is for
a. How about for you?
It leaked. It pushed. It pushed a week from. It was still in the quarter. It was the second month of the quarter, and we were trying to get it signed done in the month. I can't remember what month it was, and it ended up pushing, which is what made it not the most perfect deal. Because if it was meant to sign on that day, but they just came back and said, like, we cannot go through with the... Because we were still negotiating commercial terms at that point, even though we'd done legal terms. And it ended up getting to quite a contentious point where they wanted to bring in, like, one of the different business entities into the project as well, which would have doubled the deal size, really. But they wanted it for the same price. And the way that we price means it's not like the way sales off price, where it's by user. Imagine if you went from 100 to 200 users and says, I still want it for the same price. You can just say no. Ours doesn't necessarily work that way. It's based on and mostly priced on complexity. So we had a little bit of back and forth, but we kind of, the four of us all sat down quite amicably and said, like, this is the proposal and we kind of respect your approach. We want to get wide adoption. We don't want to limit our growth, but we'll do it. But we need to just reflect on it over the weekend. So we kind of put the brakes on the deal. They put the brakes on the deal. And we signed it the next week. It was really, really disappointing. This is something I'll never forget. It signed when I was walking the dog on my own. And I was like, just doesn't have the same kick to it. I got the notification, the dog signed on my phone. And I was like, I wish I was in the office. And I was like, I'm walking the dog. Yeah, exactly. I was in the park and I was like, this sucks a little bit. I got back and I had a phone call with my boss and we had a few laughs and blah, 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 got it done and everything. And then the next day, actually, we were in the office and went for a few drinks. And I actually went and met the champion for lunch. Me, him, and the SC went out for lunch. I had a few beers and then we went to the pub afterwards. So we did get what we wanted out of it, but it just felt that was the anticlimax. And that's what I was saying, like, remember that Q1 that we had? Like, you got to bottle that up. That was so good. That was so good. Yeah, so deal got signed. We went for lunch with a guy. We went on for a few beers. Me and James yesterday went out afterwards. And that was like, we celebrated. And it felt really satisfying. And now the lasting impact of it is we follow that process now on all of our deals. We get direct access early. We do a lot of give gets. We go on site as soon as possible. And we win the deal through style.
Would you say, as a summary, for both of our points, are the like top 3 to 5 things that reps could take away from listening to our?
Yeah. Great question. Yeah. I'd say pick your deals where you've got executive access and work them really hard and build relationships with them. Find out what the EB cares about. It's normally one thing. It's normally a strap line. In our instance, it was like consolidation of data sources across the group. And I was like, cool, I'll help you do that. The other thing is just meet in person as much as possible. It's a central theme of this podcast is like you can't beat face-to-face relationships. And if people agree to meet with you, they'll typically agree to do business with you and a much more slicker fashion. The other thing I would say is that, yeah, use your selling process and trust it, even if it means slowing the customer down sometimes. Like I said at the start, we didn't do the demo until we'd built out a decision criteria that everybody could agree on. And that feels painful at the beginning. The customers are, show me. And sometimes you have to say, like, we're not ready to show you yet. And it, that will pay dividends, even if it hurts. So those are my three major things, is build your decision criteria with your champion and make sure you don't just rush it. Get access to the EB and just try and do business face-to-face. Especially when you're talking about big ticket deals, face-to-face matters. How about you?
I would say mine are, you win a lot of your deals in the time spent outside of meetings.
Oh my God, yes, mate. You win the deal in the time spent outside the meetings, not in the meetings.
Yeah, that's where you win the deal. During your due diligence, speaking to lots of other people in the business, preparing for meetings, and then underpinning all that, I think, outside of the things that you've already said, like trying to build your value pyramids, understanding their strategic objectives, understanding the initiatives that they have to try and solve them, and also the challenges the business are facing, and make that really succinct. So when they're pitching for budget internally to help solve the challenges, like, you've done all the work for them, and you're all speaking the same language, and, you know, you're helping them sell internally, because ultimately you're helping their business.
Yeah.
And I think lastly, I'll hammer home that point, you know, like, if you don't have the opportunity to meet prospects face-to-face readily, get them on WhatsApp and start that message, like, really informally. It could be like, hey, Jack, send your follow-up email. If you've got any quick questions, feel free to fire them over from here. Like, it doesn't have to be, just make it easy, make it informal.
You can get both even better. If you can do it face-to-face and you can get a phone number, like,
double whammy.
Yeah, you should
be losing that deal.
Yeah, 100%. You can't build a better foundation for a deal there. Sick. Love it. Been waiting to do this for ages. So thanks.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. And that's episode number one of No Big Deal Series 3. Get ready, because we've got some big guests coming. Not in size, but in deal size.